from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a scene out of the 1992 movie A Few Good Men. A brash military lawyer takes on a case at Guantanamo and goes head-to-head with his employer, the United States government. In the movie, Tom Cruise wins, but that's Hollywood. On planet Earth, the U.S. Defense Department has assigned real-life military lawyer Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift to real-life legal defense duty at the Guantanamo lockup. And Lieutenant Swift is taking that assignment very, very seriously. Maybe too seriously for the Pentagon. Tonight on Point, the outspoken Navy JAG lawyer at the heart of a growing controversy over American justice and the prisoners at Guantanamo. But first, we begin tonight in Iraq. In the last day, sabotage has brought oil exports to a complete halt. Assassinations of Iraqi officials have continued. More U.S. soldiers have died. And the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has ordered his militia out of Najaf and Kufa. Farnaz Fasihi is Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. With so much going on, I asked her where Iraqi attention is most focused.
In Iraq itself, it's mainly security. What's getting attention among the Iraqi people is the attacks on the infrastructure. It's the worry that the insurgents, the terrorists, Mujahideen, whatever you are calling them, are adamant about derailing this process of the new government, and they're out to get whoever they can, attacking the foundation of the government, the infrastructure, the police, as well as the foreigners. So I think that the number one concern for a regular Iraqi is security, and they're very, very concerned when they see attacks on infrastructure, when they see that reconstruction projects, the economy may be delayed as a result of all this.
On the oil front, exports have come to a complete halt today, we're told. What's happened?
Well, there were major attacks this morning in Kirkuk, in the northern pipeline, and then in the south, and then they assassinated a senior oil advisor. So it's been very messy, and it's made the markets very nervous, as well as you mentioned, halted exports. So you have a bunch of people out there with guns and with a plan to do whatever they can to harm Iraq.
At this point, the pipelines north through Turkey are closed, and the pipelines and facilities at Basra in the south are closed. We're told this is costing Iraq $50 million or more a day. How long until they can get some oil out of there? Again, it's their main economic pillar.
It really depends on how soon they can fix it and what the security situation is. Iraq is a very big country. The pipelines are very long. And you simply can't police the entire pipeline with either American guards or private security guards. I mean, there's just so much you can do. It's the same story with the borders. The borders were not monitored and secured properly, so all these foreign fighters came in, and the same thing with the infrastructure. If it's not the oil, it's the water, it's the electricity, it's one thing after another. You just cannot police the entire government and the entire infrastructure. I mean, something has to give, and unfortunately, it's been the oil in the past 24 hours.
And what about senior officials in the Iraqi government and the interim government to come? It seems every other day now some top official is being assassinated. What kinds of measures are being taken to try and stop this, to try and protect them?
It's hard to gauge what kind of measures are being taken, because the very senior-level officials who were targets of assassination in the past, like governing council members, travel with heavy security in armed cars or with a team of bodyguards. And now it seems that this week the shift in tactic has been to go after the low to mid-ranking government officials, like the deputy foreign minister or the advisor to the education ministry and an advisor to the oil fields today, and a Baghdad professor, a Kurdish cleric over the weekend in Kirkuk. So it seems like they're just going after whoever they can go who's in any way linked with this government, whether senior or mid-level. And what makes people nervous is, what if this becomes such a big concern that officials just decide that it wasn't worth it to participate in this government and back off? And then what will happen in Iraq?
Farnaz, on another front, the radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has reportedly told his militia today to leave the cities of Najaf and Kufa, where they've been fighting there and elsewhere with U.S. troops for 8 weeks or so. There's also a signal that he may move into mainstream politics in Iraq. Is the conflict between coalition forces and Muqtada al-Sadr over? Has he taken to the straight and narrow? What's happening?
I think it would be overstating to say that the conflict is over. What we've seen over the past month or so has been that there's not really a central command with Muqtada's forces, that he has given orders a couple of times for there to be a ceasefire, not necessarily leave the city, but in times where he's ordered ceasefire, the ceasefire has not been honored. I went down to Najaf a couple of weeks ago and spoke to his spokesperson, and he said that many of these attacks are just initiated by the fighters who are on the ground and that there's no central command system. This is not a formal militia where they've been trained and where there's a commander. It's just you have gunmen in the streets who've decided to join this uprising, so it's very difficult to control them. And I'm not very optimistic about the truce holding or Muqtada's army necessarily leaving Najaf or Kufa. I mean, where are they going to go? They're going to come back to Baghdad. They're going to be dispersed, and they have guns, and pretty soon they'll be back in the streets. And as far as whether he'll be in mainstream politics, if he disarms his militia and if he pulls back and stops fighting, maybe try to form a political party out of his group and not necessarily not include himself, but somebody close to him in the National Advisory Council that is to be formed in July.
And finally, Farnaz, Saddam Hussein. The United States has said today that Iraq can indeed put him on trial, but that they will not physically give custody of him to Iraq. This is not exactly what I thought we were hearing from the new Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi. Will this be satisfactory to the new Iraqi government?
I don't think it will be satisfactory. Just the issue of detainees and prisoners of war is a sticky issue right now, because the interim government in Iraq is desperately looking for signs, tangible signs, to say we have sovereignty back, we have control over the government. Some of the signs are the return of POWs and high-profile characters like Saddam and Tariq Aziz and others who may be tried. And to not give it back to them in the eyes of Iraqi and the Arab world perhaps will be that they're still not in full control. So a lot of it is saving face. But the reality is that the Iraqis cannot secure Saddam and cannot guarantee that he will be held in a safe and secure place. So I can see the both sides.
So for the moment, a desire for security, but lots of insecurity and unease. Farnaz Fasihi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Farnaz Fasihi is Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. She spoke with me from Baghdad. Until the call came last year, U.S. Navy Judge Advocate General Lawyer Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift had fairly humdrum duty defending servicemen accused of drug use and sexual harassment. Now, Lieutenant Swift is defending a Yemeni prisoner in the American terrorist lockup at Guantanamo in what may be the world's highest profile legal drama, and Swift is fighting hard. He's reached out to the Supreme Court. He's attacked the military tribunal system, awaiting his client as deeply unjust. He's compared President Bush to King George III in the American Revolution. He has, in short, gone above and beyond the call of duty in making Guantanamo a test ground for American liberty and due process. This hour, On Point, we're talking about prisoners and justice at Guantanamo with crusading Navy JAG lawyer, Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift. Can you imagine yourself in the shoes of Charles Swift defending Osama bin Laden's driver in Guantanamo? Would you fight like hell for the rights of Salim Ahmed Hamdan or roll over under the glare of the White House, the Pentagon, and half the U.S. government? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift. Good evening and welcome, Charles Swift.
Good evening, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great, and thanks so much for joining us. You are deeper in this than all but a handful of Americans, and we're looking forward to hearing the story as it looks from inside this process, Charles Swift. I wish you'd just outline it for us exactly where things stand now. What's your job, and where do you stand in your job defending Mr. Hamdan at Guantanamo?
Well, I was detailed, or I was made available to the military commissions as a defense counsel by the Judge Advocate General of the Navy back in March of 2003. For the first 6 or 7 months, the office began to be formed under Colonel Will Gunn. I did a lot of research along with a colleague, Phil Sundell, Lieutenant Commander Phil Sundell. Looked at the international law, military law, and constitutional law that might impact the cases. And last December, on December 18th, I was detailed to represent Salim Ahmed Hamdan. Mr. Hamdan has been detained in Guantanamo Bay for going on now 2 years. And since December of last year, he's been in solitary awaiting a potential military commission.
Commission that, meaning charges?
Well, he's awaiting charges now, but a commission in and of itself doesn't mean charges. 3 other people have charges. They don't have a commission. Perhaps it's helpful for the listeners to understand what a military commission is and where it comes from.
Well, and even to take it further back than that, what we're talking about here are the military tribunals that President Bush authorized after 9/11.
Yes. Well, a military tribunal or a military commission is the different words for exactly the same thing.
Okay.
They're military hearings that have been traditionally used during time of war, a military justice substituted for the regular justice proceedings that might have occurred in the country or town, the area. Normally, they were the adjunct or the judicial part of martial law was where you first saw them, that the military had, during a conflict, had replaced or the courts weren't opening and functioning, and there was a need for law and order, so a military tribunal would deal with that. As time went on, and during the Revolutionary War, they were used, among other things, instead of a court-martial, to try other people on the opposing side that were accused of being spies. Mm-hmm. General George Washington actually had 4 of them during the Revolution. I think it's noteworthy in that period of time. General Washington used them, of course, because although we were a brand-new country, we didn't have any courts,
right,
per se, mm-hmm, and we were being set up. He understood, though, that they could be abused. And even then, even though he was arguably the most powerful person in the United States, it's certainly what would become the United States, he wrote to the Continental Congress on each occasion asking for their permission. And in each case, they gave him the permission. They were later used by General Winfield Scott in the Mexican-American War. They were used to try the Lincoln assassination, mm-hmm, conspirators after... during the Civil War, and others were held. There's a very notable trial we'll probably talk about throughout the hour called N.R.E. Milligan. Milligan is a Civil War military commission. They disappeared from the U.S. landscape at any rate until World War II, when they were used both during the war and most notably in the Supreme Court case entitled N.R.E. Quirin, and then at the end of the war. Most famous military commissions is actually an international commission. It was the Nuremberg Trials or Nuremberg Tribunals. Those aren't military commissions in the they were in one sense in that they were all military officers sitting on them, but they were different in that they were international. And there were groups, the judges and jurors were made up of the 4 Allied powers at the end of the war.
And now, Charles Swift, we have a military commission or military tribunal again. Is this commission, this tribunal, in the mold of what's preceded it?
Well, I think it, in some ways it is, in some ways it's very much not. I hope Professor Keitel can join us later when things we can talk about is,
well,
this is not a declared war. Unlike the other wars that I talked about, they were all declared wars. And it is a more amorphous war. You see, military commissions were the exception in those. Most combat was thought to be lawful. And it was only the exceptional combat that would be unlawful. In this one, we start with the idea that everyone involved on the other side is unlawfully doing so. And that makes it unique in how they would stand in history. It also is different in that we are different than we were 60 years ago. The military commission, in many ways that they've brought, mirrors that which we would have seen in R.E. Quirin. And that really, in some ways, is good, but in some ways, it's very bad. You see, at the time of Quirin, the type of justice that you see put out in the military commission rules were the same sort of justice that American service members could expect to get.
Mm-hmm.
There was no right to an attorney. There was no real appeal system put into place. There were no rules of evidence. So a military commission looked much like what a military person inside the, you know, inside the U.S. forces would have faced.
Charles Swift, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're going to come back and see exactly what your client in Guantanamo is facing today. We're talking with Navy Lieutenant Commander JAG lawyer Charles Swift. He is part of the team selected to represent enemy combatants held at Guantanamo, and he's doing that vigorously. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine yourself in the shoes of Charles Swift defending Osama bin Laden's driver in Guantanamo? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with an outspoken Navy JAG lawyer at the heart of a growing controversy over the handling of prisoners at Guantanamo. My guest is Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift. He is defending Salim Ahmad Hamdan, a 34-year-old Yemeni, a driver for Osama bin Laden, who was picked up in Afghanistan in November 2001 and taken to Guantanamo Bay. And he is defending him hard, all the way up the ladder. Question for you, would you fight like hell for the rights of Salim Ahmad Hamdan or roll over under the glare of the Pentagon, the White House, and half the U.S. government? Does Osama bin Laden's driver deserve the full protection of the United States Constitution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charles Swift, you self-describe yourself as an optimist. And as I read, and of course there was some description at length in the Times over the weekend, you got into this process optimistic that it would be fairly structured for the detainees at Guantanamo. You have grown disillusioned and are making a lot of noise about it. Why are you disillusioned in the process that you're facing?
Well, I'm on several different points, and I'd really like to, and I think I can make that point by rolling back. Mm-hmm. To a little in history, because to understand a military commission, while history may not be everybody's bag, you have to understand where it was and what it is today. And two of the absolute changes I felt that it would, I assumed when I was assigned to it, that the military commission would comply with the two most important legal documents as far as the U.S. military was concerned, that came into being after World War II, and that was the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which was passed in 1950, mm-hmm. and the Geneva Conventions of 1949. That process, basically under the conventions, the process would mirror the type of judicial process that I'd worked in for the last 9 years, that had evolved to where, to the extent practicable, military persons and persons facing military justice received the same protections as ordinary citizens. And the military justice, unlike there had been a saying that military justice was to justice what military music is to music. Mm. And as a practitioner in the last 9 years, I found that it had really changed. We had evolved significantly. And I expected the system to be similar.
And in fact, in the tribunals created by President Bush, as I understand it, you're saying they violate the U.S. Constitution, they violate federal law, they violate the Geneva Convention, they violate the Uniform Code of Military Justice. How?
Well, that's a long answer because there's a whole bunch of different points there. I'll start probably with the Constitution and work my way down. How's that?
Okay.
The first concern comes under the Constitution. Under Article 1, Section 8, Congress, not the President, is supposed to make international law that's to be enforced. And the first thing that's of great concern in the way that the military commissions have been set up are the offenses themselves that the President invoked. Based on memos that I've read and the fact that there's no citation, the President seems to have pulled the crimes that are to be tried out of this, basically written the law himself. That's unconstitutional. It's beyond his powers. Congress is the legislative branch. The President is not.
But it's simply been done in this case. The President just did it.
Without citation, and in a recent one of the memos that was released from the General Counsel's Office of the White House was that, well, we would use the common law, common international law. That, as a lawyer, I found that extraordinary.
Okay, point one.
Because the Geneva Conventions, which are the most ratified treaty in the world, set out all of the crimes of war. And Congress had gone so far as to enact a War Crimes Act, which made those criminal acts inside the United States. So it didn't seem, A, that we needed more crimes or that the field was such that there was a common law existing outside of the Geneva Conventions. As such, it seems to be a real problem with Article 1, Section 8 powers of the President, in probably where he's his weakest, because we're not even in a declared war at this point. So, again, it seemed to be an extreme stretch in this one for the executive branch to say, I'm capable of legislating here, I'm capable of enforcement, and I'm going to be the and I'm going to exclude the judicial branch.
In other words,
I'm going to bring all three branches of government together underneath myself for this purpose.
Hence, your King George reference. You've gone on to say that under this emerging system, as it's come, you won't necessarily be able to see the evidence against your client. Hearsay would be permitted. There would be no appeals process beyond a four-member review panel handpicked by the Secretary of Defense. All these you've objected to.
Absolutely. None of it is reflective of American justice. One of the things that's upset me in representing Mr. Hamdan throughout this is when officials have said that this is a full and fair trial, that this will be a full and fair trial. As a criminal defense attorney, all I've ever asked for my clients is a full and fair trial. And that's all anyone could ask for. I don't think any U.S. citizen is entitled to more.
But you said
a full and fair trial.
You said in this case it's like a Monty Python movie where the government, to quote you, has this wonderful suit of armor, a lance and a sword, and all I've been given is a sharp stick to defend my client.
That, I think it's a pretty apt analogy. My question in the standpoint is that by saying that this is a full and fair trial, we make a mockery of the Bill of Rights. We say we really don't need any of those things for a fair trial. All of that's legal technicalities, that we don't need a separation of government. We don't need a judicial branch. All of those things are luxuries. We don't actually need any of that for a full and fair trial. And that strikes me as extremely dangerous.
Okay. On the other hand, we had 9/11, and your client sounds like someone very close to Osama bin Laden, easily presented as a fierce threat to the United States. Tell us about your client, Salim Abin Hamdan.
Well, so Mr. Hamdan first went to Afghanistan around 1995. He's not very clear on dates. He didn't go to join al-Qaeda. He had been recruited instead to fight in Tajikistan.
Neighboring Afghanistan.
What's that?
Just neighboring Afghanistan there.
Neighboring Afghanistan, yes. And there were religious struggles. As the former Soviet Union was collapsing, there were struggles throughout that area of the world. Along the process of getting there, he decided he really didn't want to be part of it. And it was in the process of going home when someone asked him if he was willing to be a driver, when he was approached and asked if he'd like work. You have to understand that most Yemenis look for jobs outside of Yemen. Mm-hmm. Yemen does not have a very strong economy, and in fact, its second greatest source of income is remittances from people working outside of Yemen.
But this wasn't just any job. This wasn't a construction job in Bombay.
No, not exactly, although he didn't really understand what it was when he went out to get it. He was told that there was a job available for drivers, and he did have that skill. He'd been a taxi driver in Yemen, and so he was eager for it, and as he went out to the site to find out about the hiring, he heard that the person doing the hiring was Osama bin Laden. Now, this is 1995, and his major thought was, good, I have a great chance of getting the job because he's descended from Yemenis, and
right,
they're likely to hire me. And he was hired on in the position of working for him. He initially drove agricultural workers. Mr. bin Laden had set up a compound. He had agricultural land that he owned and on which he was growing crops, and he hired local Afghans to work there. He lived a pretty way out of town, so if you wanted, and there was no regular bus service, if you wanted to get workers there, you had to have them driven, or they'd spent most of their day walking from work. He did that for a while, and eventually he also drove members of Mr. bin Laden's family and Osama bin Laden himself on occasion.
Is your client a terrorist?
He absolutely denies it. He says that he was never a member of al-Qaeda. He was never a member of the Taliban. He did this for the oldest of reasons, money. He was being paid to work for Mr. bin Laden, and for him it was a good job. It paid $200 a month, more than he could ever expect to make in Yemen. It was hazardous because there was an ongoing civil war in Afghanistan, but his prospects for employment weren't much better anywhere else.
And now he's been sitting in Guantanamo for 2 years. You have found him in solitary confinement. Do you have access to him?
Yeah, I do. I visit him at least once a month for a couple of days during the period of time. The biggest challenge at the beginning was to find a qualified translator. Although much had gone into setting up military commissions, when I was appointed, they didn't have a translator for me. I was fortunate that I was able to find a very qualified translator, and That's been important in forming a relationship.
Lieutenant Swift, as we talk tonight, are you confident that your client in Guantanamo will get a fair trial or something close enough to fair?
Well, I'm not confident that my client will ever get a trial, more or less a fair one. At this point, in February, we put in a demand for a speedy trial. Unlike everyone else down there, we said, try us. Please, bring charges. We'd like the opportunity to face them. He's maintained his innocence. And to date, it's now June, we've heard nothing from them. No charges were produced. Instead, we got a one-sentence document saying that we weren't entitled to a speedy trial.
And meanwhile, you've been kicking up your heels on a lot of fronts. Have you been told by anyone in the military to, in effect, shut up and sit down, Lieutenant Swift? Don't make so much noise about this.
Well, no. And, you know, I'm not listening very hard for it either. I listened to the intro, and I did find it kind of amusing. I don't think of myself as a crusader. I think of myself as a defense counsel. It burns at me, or did in any period of time, when there was insinuation that if you wanted a fair trial in military justice or in any type of a situation, that you had to hire a civilian defense counsel because a military defense counsel wouldn't try hard. I've ever had, tried my absolute best. The idea is follow. Once I'm detailed to do it, represent someone, then I feel that their defense shouldn't be any different if I'm defending them than any civilian defense attorney would do. I use the best of my skills. I try my absolute best to provide them a zealous, full, fair defense. And in the context of that, give them insight and counseling. I've often felt that quite often, whether it be a military member or even in this case, you may be better represented by a military attorney because they better know the system.
But meanwhile, you've got people in the military making noises about your efforts to raise the profile of the situation that are not entirely complimentary. Lieutenant Swift, if you'd stand by, I want to welcome into our conversation Neil Katyal. He's joining us from Washington. He's a law professor at Georgetown University. He's volunteered his services to the team defending Guantanamo detainees. He co-wrote with Lawrence Tribe an article in the Yale Law Journal assailing the military tribunals. Good evening and welcome, Neil Katyal.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. What got you involved in this whole situation?
Well, after President Bush announced his order on November 13th of 2001, I read the order. I had done a bunch of national security work at the Justice Department, and my academic specialty is separation of powers, and I became very concerned about how gravely this order flouted basic American notions of justice and separation of government. So I testified on the Hill a couple weeks later before the Senate Judiciary Committee towards the end of November 2001, and then was fortunate enough to write with Boston's own Larry Tribe that piece that you referred to. And then I just began studying and reading about the system and writing more. And then I met up with the defense counsel and had the privilege and honor of representing them.
And now you're representing Charles Swift in a lawsuit that he's filed in federal district court in Seattle, his hometown, against George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, arguing that civilian courts have the jurisdiction to hear a challenge to these tribunals. What's the status of that case?
Yeah, absolutely. We filed this lawsuit back in April, and it's pending and before the trial court, the federal trial court in Seattle. The trial judge there is awaiting the Supreme Court decisions on Guantanamo Bay next week, which aren't about military tribunals, but rather they're about just the ordinary detainee and whether they have access to the courts. The trial judge wanted to await those rulings and then have some additional papers from us, and then we will have oral argument in the case in September.
Neil Katyal, you presumably saw, like the rest of us, I mean, this wasn't how this was supposed to unfold, was it? This kind of spirited defense. We had the sense that these tribunals would go ahead on their own arc here. But now you and Lieutenant Swift and a few others seem to be pulling this into the full process of U.S. justice. Is that happening? Are you succeeding in that? Are you confident that what will end up emerging from this is something that you can look at and call a fair trial?
Well, when the president announced his order, one of the things that bothered me the most was that it actually tried to cut off explicitly in the order itself access to the civilian courts. And after an outcry from The Hill and columnists as diverse as William Sapphire, the administration promised to make civilian court review available. They then warehoused all of these people at Guantanamo Bay and backtracked on that to try and retrench from that promise. I believe that what the administration has done here is constitutionally dubious and a basic flouting of international law and United States military law principles. And I'm confident that American courts will recognize just how dangerous and illegal this system of military commissions is.
And what's your sense of your own client's situation? Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift, who's with us tonight, is he getting himself in hot water here? Are the courts going to protect him, Neil Cattell, or is he getting under the skin of the Pentagon higher-ups in a way that may be detrimental to his own career?
Well, I'm sure that he's getting under the skin of any number of people. But the one bright spot in this entire sorry saga since November 2001 is that the administration has let him do his job. I don't think, and I would disagree a little with your characterization before, that he's outspoken or something like that. I actually think that a number of people within the American military itself rebel at what the administration and the civilian leadership of the Pentagon is doing here to destroy the Geneva Conventions, which is a source of pride for the American military. They're proud of the way they treat prisoners of war and deal with, and they're proud of the military justice system. This administration has made the conscious decision to run roughshod over that long tradition in history.
Well, I don't know about outspoken, but he's suing the president and the defense secretary. He's filing friend of the court brief with the Supreme Court, and this is no shrinking violet you're representing, Neil Cattell.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it takes some guts to do this, but let me say that behind Commander Swift lies, I think, a substantial body of military servicemen and women who I get letters from them all the time saying, go for what you're doing because you're defending us.
Neil Cattell, we have to take a break, but I want to thank you for joining us. I know I've got to let you go. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure.
Neil Cattell, law professor at Georgetown University, representing Commander Charles Swift, as Charles Swift fights a full front battle for his client, a detainee at Guantanamo. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you hear in the passion of Charles Swift? Is this a defender of the fundamental principles of American justice? Is this a maverick who's gone too far for an enemy combatant? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charles Swift, stand by. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with an outspoken Navy JAG lawyer at the heart of a growing controversy over the handling of prisoners at Guantanamo. My guest is Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift. On the team selected to represent enemy combatants held at Guantanamo Bay, you can join the conversation. What should we learn from Charles Swift's David and Goliath battle? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tony's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hello. I guess I just want to say to the Lieutenant Commander, I recently was discharged from the Army. I'm an Army reservist, hopefully soon a retired Army reservist. I sent in my request for retirement, having received my 20-year letter.
Okay.
And I just wanted to say that I'm behind him 100%. I served in Bagram at the Personnel Collection Facility.
Just outside Kabul in Afghanistan.
Oh, about 25 miles
right.
Due north-northeast, yes, in Parwan province.
And when you hear that Charles Swift is going to the wall for detainees in Guantanamo, what do you think?
I think it needs to be done. I hope if I'm ever in trouble, I have a lawyer who's willing to look down the face of the opposition he's facing. Frankly, I cannot tell you much about what went on at Bagram, simply because we had to sign non-disclosure agreements. I don't know if I'd have the moral courage to take the stand that he's taken. I do know that in the past, or all the way back to the time of George Washington, we have always had Army commanders and commanders-in-chiefs who insisted that we treat enemy prisoners of war as humane as possible, with or without a Geneva Convention.
Has that happened at Bagram in your experience, Tony?
In my experience, it was generally the rule. I saw exactly one thing that my view was extreme. I signed a sworn statement to that effect. I can't tell you what I said. I am at peace that I was taken seriously and that the matter was handled seriously.
But if those detainees came to trial or you came to trial, you're saying you'd like to have Charles Swift in your corner. Charles Swift, there's a vote of support from a recently returned Army reservist who's just back from Afghanistan. What kind of feedback, Tony, thank you for your call. Charles Swift, what kind of feedback are you getting from military personnel?
Well, by and large, it's positive. I think that there's times when people have difficulty understanding it. That's also to be expected. Every time that I've represented anyone, for instance, someone who's accused of dealing or distributing narcotics to the unit, there are those in the unit who are pretty angry. And the accusation alone and the idea that someone's being defended can upset them. But you know, when they start to think about it and think about what we stand for and why we're doing this, then most people come back around and say, you know, without a defense, without law, without due process, none of this makes any sense. And so by and large, I've had a positive feedback. I've been listening to your comments. I'm delighted you ask in being outspoken or in that sense. I think I'm just trying to follow some of the models that were set in military commissions or military-type proceedings, the most famous of which occurred up in Boston. Sort of a military commission. It was a trial. If you might recall, you guys had something, I think it was called the Boston Massacre.
Yeah, we
and the British soldiers had fired on a crowd. And it was a pretty big deal in Boston, and
sure
they were
was.
Having a real hard time finding a defense attorney for them. Do you know who defended them?
I don't.
John Adams. He lost half his practice for doing it. However, was extremely successful. Only one person was convicted, and all he received, he was convicted of a minor charge and received a brand. The rest were acquitted.
Commander Swift, I want to get one more call when our time is so short.
Sure.
That's a good name, John Adams. We'll remember it. Michael's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Sure. Hi. I just had a couple of quick comments.
Please.
First of all, this guy is not a U.S. citizen, and he was picked up in an enemy, you know, an enemy combatant.
This is Mr. Hamdan, Bin Laden's driver. Yes.
Yes. You know, I think the commander is doing the right thing to give him a vigorous defense, but he sounds terminally naive when he says that this guy is just as an innocent. You know, if you think about how many people are in the U.S. prison system who would tell you that they're innocent, I would say it's probably a vast majority of those folks. So I'm not buying that story. And it seems to harm the story to argue that this guy is an innocent.
Michael, our time is so short, I want to go straight to Commander Swift with that. Charles Swift.
Sure.
We've just got a minute remaining.
Okay. I've been a criminal defense attorney for 9 years. I'm not an innocent. I think the important thing you talked about in the American prison system was they got there after a trial. And they may still be claiming that they're innocent or not. In the sense, from that standpoint, the only way we can know whether I'm right, wrong, or what actually it's not me, it's Mr. Hamdan's claims that ought to be heard, is in a fair judicial process. Then we'll know. I'm not saying that you should prejudge or that he should be released without process. What I'm saying is that there should be process and it should be fair. And that's not to prejudge it either way. We can't decide his guilt or innocence here on the radio this evening.
Charles,
we need a fair hearing to do that.
We've got half a minute left. What's your confidence that your client and others in Guantanamo will get a fair hearing ultimately?
I think that, like Professor Katyal, I still have great faith in the American judicial system. I have great faith in Seattle and our opportunity to be heard. And if this court case eventually makes it into the U.S. judicial system, I'm confident of a fair outcome.
But we also heard that long pause. We thank you for being with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us. Navy Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift, JAG lawyer on the team selected to represent enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, celebrating 100 years of Bloom's Day. This is On Point. A 100 years ago today, June 16, 1904, James Joyce's Leopold Bloom stepped out into the streets of Dublin in the pages of Joyce's Ulysses, and one of the greatest English novels of the 20th century was born. Here's Joyce reading in 1927 from the only known recording of Ulysses in his own voice.
"We would never have led the chosen people out of their house of bondage, nor followed the pillar of the cloud by day. We would never have spoken with the Eternal on Sinai's mountain top, nor ever have come down with the lights of inspiration shining in his countenance and bearing in his arms the tables of the law, graven in the language of the outlaw."
16th today it is, thought Leopold Bloom, whose vast interior monologue is the realm of Ulysses. Joyce's revolutionary novel was published in 1922 to both high critical acclaim and high controversy. The book was banned in many countries and not published in the United States until 1934. In the years since, Leopold Bloom's epic ramble has come to be celebrated around the world, from the streets of Dublin to today's special Bloom's Day logo on Google's homepage. Isaiah Scheffer is host of NPR's Selected Shorts and co-founder of New York City's Symphony Space. Today, he is hosting Bloom's Day on Broadway, a 12-hour performance of Ulysses in New York. In this radio diary, Isaiah Scheffer and actress Carrot O'Brien celebrate the 100th anniversary of James Joyce's Bloom's Day.
Well, James Joyce continues to compel people's imagination and fascination long after his death, and it's quite remarkable that people tend to celebrate a fictional occurrence. I don't know of another example of it in literature. Nobody celebrates the day that Ishmael signed on board to sail with Captain Ahab, or when Huck and Tom got on the raft, but they do celebrate this day that Mr. Bloom and Stephen Dedalus and Molly Bloom spend in Dublin, the 16th of June, 1904. Joyce wrote a set of short stories called Dubliners, and he wrote one of them that was about a man who rescues himself. Stephen Dedalus, the stand-in for Joyce, rescues him in a drunken brawl and keeps him out of the policeman's hands and gets him home safe and sober. And then he realized that that little story could be the seed of a much larger book, in fact, the epic novel of the 20th century, Ulysses. And he changed that man's name, Mr. Hunter, to Mr. Bloom, a wandering Jew, and the kind of Odysseus figure, a Ulysses, who walks around Dublin the way Ulysses toured around the Mediterranean.
Reactions of Joyce's contemporaries from Ulysses, which there was people like Gertrude Stein spoke out against the book, although she begrudgingly said she thought Joyce was underrated. The writer of Mrs. Dalloway, Virginia Woolf, spoke up against a book, saying it was a horrible book, and never mind that a couple years later she went on to write a novel that took place on one day in the life of a woman this time. So the controversy of people saying it's a great book, it's an unreadable book, started when the book was first published and very much so continues today.
Here's a little excerpt from the eighth episode of Joyce's Ulysses. It's 1 p.m. and he's wandering through the streets of Dublin. He meets a few acquaintances along the way, including his one-time girlfriend, Josie McBride, now the dotty Mrs. Breen, who tells him about the latest obsession of her equally dotty husband, Dennis Breen.
"Oh, Mr. Bloom, How do you do?
Oh, how do you do, Mrs. Breen?
No use complaining. How is Molly these times? Haven't seen her for ages.
In the pink, Mr. Bloom said gaily. Millie has a position down in Mullingar, you know.
Go away! Isn't that grand for her?
Yes, and a photographer's there. Getting on like a house afire. How are all your charges?
All on the baker's list,
Mrs. Breen said. How many has she? No other in sight.
You're in black, I see. You have no...
No, I've just come from a funeral.
Going to crop up all day, I foresee. Who's dead, when, and what did he die of? Turn up like a bad penny.
Oh, dear me.
Mrs. Breen said.
I hope it wasn't any near relation.
May as well get her sympathy.
Dignam, Mr. Bloom said. An old friend of mine. He died quite suddenly, poor fellow. Heart trouble, I believe. Funeral was this morning.
Your funeral's tomorrow while you're coming through the rye. Diddle-diddle-dum-dum, diddle-diddle-dum.
Said to lose the old friend.
Mrs. Breen's woman eyes said melancholily. Now, that's quite enough about that. Just quietly. Husband.
And your lord and master?
Mrs. Breen turned up her two large eyes. Hasn't lost them, anyhow.
Don't be talking. He's a caution to rattlesnakes. He's in there now with his law books, finding out the law of libel. He has me heart scalded. Wait till I show you.
Hot mock turtle vapor and steam of new-baked jam puffs, roly-poly, poured out from Harrison's. The heavy noon reek tickled the top of Mr. Bloom's gullet. Want to make good pastry, butter, best flour, demerara sugar, or they taste it with the hot tea. Or is it from her? A barefoot Arab stood over the grating, breathing in the fumes. Deadened the gnaw of hunger that way. Pleasure or pain, is it? Penny dinner, knife and fork, chained to the table. What makes me passionate about it is that it is a great celebration of life and love and lust and literature and springtime. Joyce put everything into this book. It has every aspect of human activity, male and female, every body part, every enterprise, sport, sex, music, accidents, violence, politics.
Joyce went for all the marbles as an artist. He never was in any kind of financial safe place in his life. He lived on the money of patrons, but he knew his work. He was writing for the ages and that people would be thinking about it and writing about it and that he would change the course of modern literature, which he did.
Joyce's Ulysses is a great affirmation of life and love. It ends with a very resounding yes. And it's not just Molly Bloom's sexual yes. It's a life-affirming yes. And that's what I hope people are left with year after year as they celebrate Bloom's Day.
Isaiah Sheffer is co-founder and artistic director of Symphony Space in New York, host of NPR's Selected Shorts, and wrote the introduction to the new book, Yes, I Said, Yes, I Will, Yes, a celebration of James Joyce Ulysses and 100 Years of Bloomsday. He, Carrot O'Brien, and a cast of hundreds are performing a 12-hour-long adaptation of Ulysses today in New York. Special thanks to the James Joyce of radio, our own James Ross. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.